Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We have the privilege of working closely with one of the most astute and I think knowledgeable experts on communist China and the party that rules it. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a regular contributor to these programs, but we don't often get a chance to talk with him in depth and at length, and I always appreciate it when we have such a chance, and one is afforded to us with the relatively recent publication of his book that he co-authored with Lian Chao Han, entitled "The Understanding the China Threat," and it gets at the heart of the matter. Namely, that we confront in our time an existential threat to freedom, unlike any our nation has experienced heretofore. And we're delighted to have a full hour to visit with Thad about that particular proposition, but also what the Chinese Communist Party is doing day in and day out to make more and more, well, palpable the danger that it poses, not just to its own people, of course, but to others, including ours, around the world. And let me just say, Dr. Thayer is a renowned academic, as well as a very accomplished author and prodigiously productive essayist. You can find his works at places like The Hill and Epic Times. He is, of course, now the director of the Center for Security Policy's China program, for which we're very grateful. And with all of that, let me just say, at last, welcome, Dr. Thayer. It's good to have you back with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Good. Let me start by asking you about your most recent column, which appeared at The Hill. It's entitled, "A Dangerous History Repeats. Xi Jinping's regime is insecure and illegitimate." Let's start with the back end of that. Illegitimacy is a key problem for a totalitarian regime. Ronald Reagan understood that and exploited it very effectively against the last totalitarian communist system that sought our destruction, the Soviet Union. Tell us why you consider the Chinese Communist Party to be illegitimate, why we all should, and why we might be able to do the same with them in that regard.
Well, certainly, Frank, this cuts to the heart of the matter and is an absolutely fundamental issue in the ideological or political warfare that is going on between the Chinese people and the Chinese Communist Party, but also between the West and the Chinese Communist Party. So it gets to a fundamental issue. The Chinese Communist Party is illegitimate because they've never asked the Chinese people or consulted the Chinese people, and thus they do not have any mandate. They don't have any mandate from the people to rule. They seized power, in essence, like an Argentinian junta, right? I mean, they simply took power.
On steroids, I think one might say. Yeah.
Certainly, indeed. So they seized power within China, and they have only been abusive towards the people they purport to govern or to govern in the name of the Chinese people.
Yes. So because that's putting it charitably, I think I have to say, Brad, as you know, just completed a new book with your help entitled "The Indictment," and it starts by talking about the unprecedentedly horrific crimes against humanity that this party has inflicted upon its people, and those of the captive nations, of course, that China has enslaved along the trail. Just give a little bit more texture to how egregious that behavior has been.
Well, indeed, Frank, and you label them a transnational criminal enterprise, and that's really what a communist party is. They're a gang of thugs, a gang of criminals, who are vicious to one another. That is that there's tremendous brutality in the history of the Chinese Communist Party towards other communists, of course, but also to the Chinese people. As you note, the abuses against the Chinese people started even before they came to power in 1949. And after they came to power, they only accelerated with executions, show trials. Everything that you would expect from a communist government was present. And then perhaps most
agreed. Gulags, genocide.
And famine. Right?
As a weapon against the people.
Weapon against the people that Frank Dickhotter in his great book, Mao's Great Famine, estimates that there may have been as many as 45 million people killed. Lower estimates are 15 to 20 million people killed in those years, really between late 1958 and the end of 1961, beginning of 1962, when the situation began to be reversed. So in that,
but let me ask you, Brad. I've heard numbers as high as 100 million all in terms of what Mao and company have done over the years.
Well, certainly,
and that's without counting the numbers that they've murdered in utero as a result
Indeed.
Of their population stuff.
Yes.
I gather they've actually acknowledged some 400 million murdered in that fashion. I mean, this is. I mean, the mind reels at how staggering. This is against, again, their own people. And I guess the question that I have for you is there any reason to believe they would treat ours better if they had a chance?
Of course not. There's no reason whatsoever to think that they would be, if they're treating the Chinese people in this way, they would treat the denizens, the citizens of any other country, even worse than their own citizens. Particularly as we see, there are Chinese people, there are non-Han people within China, of course. And here we see the abuse against those minorities, particularly Tibetans, Mongols, Manchus to some degree. And then, of course, against Muslims, against the ethnically Uyghur or Kazakh or Kyrgyz Muslims, largely in Xinjiang. Province in China's west, where we have seen a gulag, of course, ongoing genocide and profound human rights abuses, which have been ongoing for decades now against against these Muslims.
So, would you digress for just a second to talk a little bit about the thing that you've described as, I think, animating all of that? Han centrism was a term, I think, that you've gotten the title of one of your books, and it's really stuck with me. The racism that is exhibited by this party, which is very quick to point out, you know, our past difficulties with race in this country, but yet never acknowledges, you know, the magnitude of its own.
No, they don't, and it really. Defines their rule of profound xenophobia, ethnocentrism, and racist behavior, particularly towards darker complexion people, where when they're looking at people in South Asia, Indians, of course, they're contemptuous of the Indians for a variety of reasons, but largely because they see them as inferior people, because they have a darker complexion. Africans, of course, time and again, there are innumerable incidences of African students or shows or the portrayal of Africans on Chinese media as being, in essence, less than human, as bordering on barbarians, bordering on animals. And this is a constant theme in the treatment.
Hold the thought, Brad. We have to come right back. We're talking for this full hour with Dr. Bradley Thayer, the co-author of Understanding the China Threat. We'll be right back with more, much more, on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Have you noticed the peculiar reporting about the mass murder at a Nashville elementary school yesterday? It's striking as much for what is not being said as what is. Consider, for example, how this shooting would have been covered if a practicing Christian had attacked a school or other venue populated by so-called transgender individuals instead of the other way around. You can bet the narrative would have been all about the threat posed to a victimized community by militant Christianity, and the perpetrator's character and associates would have been exhaustively critiqued. In this case, we need to examine and determine if government officials' othering of Christians as potential domestic terrorists and violent extremists is contributing to increasing persecution of believers here. Moreover, whether such behavior was a decisive factor in this attack or not, it must be condemned and stopped now. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Dr. Bradley Thayer, the director of the Center for Security Policy's China program these days, and a very impressive expert on communist China and the party that animates that really deeply troubled nation for a variety of reasons, which we will discuss in greater detail in a moment. But we've been talking about the illegitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, Brad. And I just wanted to see if you thought there is an opportunity at this moment to shed more intense light on just not only how horrific this regime has been, but why it really has no legitimate claim to rule the Chinese people and should be, well, taken down.
Well, indeed, it doesn't have a legitimate claim. It's illegitimate because it has never consulted. It has never received a mandate from the Chinese people to rule the people, even though it purports to have that. Its behavior, of course, is defined by genocide. It's defined by famine. It's defined by the most profound human rights abuses directed against their own people, against minorities in China and elsewhere, of course. And this is a regime that seeks to export its ideology. It seeks to export its control over other countries, including the United States and key U.S. allies. So it's very important that the rest of the world recognizes that it's illegitimate, as the CCP itself recognizes that it is. And that feeds its insecurity. That helps to fuel its aggression. Its aggression is rooted in its ideology of communism, but it is also, and this is inherent in communism, rooted in a profound insecurity and fear about the rest of the world and fear that, if you will, the citizenry is going to reject it if it has the freedom, if it has the opportunity to do so, because they know that they're oppressive. They know that they're a criminal enterprise, thugs, gangs of gangsters ruling the country. And that insecurity is often shared by dictatorships. Stalin, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. There were some people within the Soviet Union, a minority to be sure, who truly believed in communism, who truly believed in what Lenin had, if you will, bequeathed or birthed in 1917. And certainly that existed through Mikhail Suslov and his death, who was the last Stalinist, if you will, or the last true communist. He died in 1982. But the overwhelming majority of the Soviet people did not believe. They knew that it was a lie. They knew and they tried to, if you will, live under its oppression and work around it to the extent that they were able.
They too had suffered massively at the hands of the communists, much as Mao's
people. Indeed, absolutely. Neville Henderson's great report, who was the ambassador, representative of the Court of St. James, of course, in Berlin, that is representing His Majesty's government, in Berlin before the outbreak of war in September of 1939, shared his reflections in his account of those years, of Neville Chamberlain's assessment as well. And they both shared the belief that Hitler was a profoundly insecure ruler, and that for Hitler, the Germans, of course, were a great people, but everywhere they were oppressed, everywhere they were abused. So it was that rather curious attention where the Germans were the world's best people, but at the same time, they were picked on, abused, humiliated worldwide. You see this with Xi Jinping's statements time and again. The Chinese are the best people under the leadership of the Communist Party of China, and yet they're abused, they're picked on by these sinister and hostile forces that surround them and that abuse them. So,
you know, the interesting thing about this insecurity, though, Brad, is that some of it manifests itself from within China itself, and the
indeed
hostility of the Chinese people towards this regime, which was evidenced with that black paper, rioting that was
yes
taking place not so long ago, and just describe, if you would, because this is another lesson of history, is how totalitarian regimes, communist and otherwise, tend to respond when faced with that kind of insecurity inside the realm, if you will.
Well, when faced with it, of course, they typically crack down, and through the security services, of course, which defines China's the rule of the Communist Party of China. Again, the profound suspicion of the people, and thus they have to be monitored constantly, and they have to be kept under a strict control. Because if they are allowed to voice their opinions, as you said, Frank, we saw in the blank paper protests in November, December of 22, where you had that outbreak, you had protests in all of China's major cities. You had really an expression of the Chinese people's will and the rejection of the Chinese Communist Party. They successfully suppressed it. To be sure, but it's not the last one. We're going to see additional protests in the future, and we don't know what will cause it and what the event will be, but nonetheless, they are inevitable because of, if you will, the tension. The simple fact of the Communist Party and its rule is going to generate resistance against it, and no matter how much they invest in facial recognition software, or identity recognition software, or block monitors, or the host of measures that they use to control
their population. Millions and millions of cameras and the social credit system. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But just to, if I could, just to wrap this segment, because we have to take a short break, Brett, there. The other piece of this lesson of history is that when totalitarian regimes feel insecure, threatened by their own people, then they will indeed, as you say, typically crack down on them. But oftentimes they justify the crackdown by blaming some foreign boogeyman, some external threat that everyone has to rally around the flag and accept the privations of additional, you know, sacrifice in order to protect the motherland in this case. Brett, we're going to, as I say, take a very short break. When we come back, I want to pick up on that thought and why it means a lot to us. Stay tuned.
Night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we are visiting with Dr. Bradley Thayer, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he runs our China program. He is to be found in all the right places, it seems, notably Steve Bannon's War Room, among others, as well as this program, of course, but also in the pages of The Hill and Epoch Times and other journals. We were talking, Brad, about some tremendously important symptoms of problems within China and the historical antecedents that are perhaps predictive, at least instructive. And one of the things that I wanted to just stitch into all of this is when totalitarians, as you say, feel their illegitimacy is translating into insecurity at home, they not only feel the need to crack down, but they are also prepared to manufacture, in some cases, or otherwise manipulate their people's sensitivities to external threats. This is so important because we're seeing, as you've contributed to a terrific webinar we did last week at the presentdangerchina.org site, strongly commended to everyone, about China's preparations for war. And you've made the case, among others, very powerfully that it is indeed preparing not just for the kind of unrestricted warfare they've engaged in all these years, but actually the shooting war kind. Talk a little bit about how that fits into this pattern of totalitarians and whether we should be very concerned about it.
Indeed, we should, because it's happening now, and it could happen. The attack against Taiwan, for example, is something that Xi Jinping has pledged. He's pledged to conquer Taiwan, although in his remarks, it's always implied, if it's not made explicitly, that it would be many years to come. But there's ample evidence that this is happening now, that they are taking major steps and fundamental steps to lay the foundation for war against Taiwan, which of course would involve Japan, Australia, and the United States, and additionally other allies. What are we seeing with Xi Jinping? Well, what we're receiving is strategic indicators of an attack. We're getting intelligence that he's preparing for war, Not in the sense that he's a tactical indication that he's launching a missile, right? That hasn't come yet. The kinetic, the final chapter would be the kinetic one. What we're looking at is the preceding chapters, where he's laying the foundation for conflict, and we really see five of them. First, in Guangdong, there was the release of a video in May of 2022. In that video, party leaders and military leaders were conveying to provincial officials that they needed to prepare for conflict. They needed to prepare their province, in essence, for conflict, and we should expect that that was done in other provinces as well. Secondly, at the 20th Party Congress of the Chinese Communist Party in October of 2022, Xi Jinping stated explicitly that Taiwan was going to be conquered. Those weren't his precise terms, but that was the thrust of it, and that the United States was a threat. He didn't label the United States as a threat directly, that will come later, but he certainly targeted the United States as an enemy of China. Thirdly, Mike Minahan's memo, which was leaked at the end of January 2023.
That's General Mike Minahan.
That's Air Force General, U.S. Air Force General Mike Minahan, who is the commander of Air Mobility Command, obviously a very important command for supporting logistically, of course, U.S. Armed Forces worldwide, stated that there were three events that allow him to expect conflict in 2025. Now, the precise date is, it may be sooner, certainly, but those three events were, first, that Xi Jinping had formulated a war council in October of 22, right? Very likely coincidental or shortly before or shortly after the 20th Party Congress. Secondly, the Taiwanese election in 24, and then also the US presidential election in 24, allowed him to expect that the China would aggress in 25. Now, of course, there's also good arguments it would be 23, it could be 24 as well. Fourth, Xi Jinping's statements, which he made in March 6th, those statements were revealed where for the first time in an address, he's talking about the United States by name as attempting to encircle, attempting to suppress China, and that contain China as well, he mentioned, which is, of course, notable because he's discussing the United States directly as a consequence. And then his speech that he provided last week at the end of really the National People's Congress, where that theme was present again.
Along with this idea of global governance, with, I think it's fair to say, Chinese characteristics, as he would put it, no?
Indeed. There's no doubt that he's very active in political warfare. Not a week goes by where he's not making major efforts. And his activity is in direct contrast to our inactivity, the inactivity of the Biden administration in this respect. But indeed, he's doing everything.
Passivity is another word for it, I think, if not appeasement, accommodation, and submission. So, Brad, let's jump forward, because as we speak, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin of Russia are conferring in Moscow. The last time they got together in one of their capitals, the upshot of it seems to have been the green lighting by Xi Jinping of the invasion of Ukraine. If we're right that Xi has his own internal reasons for now being not just preparing for conflict, but actually ready to begin it. What should we be watching for? What should we worry about coming out of this meeting in Moscow?
We should be worried about really this pattern of behavior. We should be worrying about a tightening alliance relationship between Moscow and Beijing. So, Frank, as you noted, at the Winter Olympics, just after the Winter Olympics in February 2022, Putin and Xi met, where Xi gave Putin, without doubt, the green light to attack Ukraine. In Samarkand, in September of 22, they met again. at the SCO conference, and that was notable because of Xi's support, continued support for Putin. And now, of course, they're meeting in Moscow, and we'll meet in the future, of course, in Beijing. So a series of meetings to show the strength of the alliance relationship.
The so-called no limits partnership between
indeed.
The two.
Mm-hmm. So Putin is getting China's support. And China is getting
how does that translate into material benefit to the Russian regime?
It translates into a prodigious material benefit in terms of a resource for their products, energy products, particularly economic support by working to undermine global SWIFT system, the banking system that the United States put in place, and which helps to enforce our sanctions that we have against Russia. It also helps in military aid that China is sending directly or indirectly to Russia to allow it to continue to propagate its war against Ukraine. And we need to keep in mind, of course, that from China's perspective, China had a great relationship with Ukraine. And there was a lot of Russian or Soviet technology, missile technology, aircraft engine technology, the aircraft carrier, actually, which Ukraine transferred to China. So China has had positive relationships with both Moscow and Kyiv. So Putin is getting Chinese support, which is absolutely essential, and Xi is sending a political message that the rest of the world, the West may criticize Putin, but the rest of the world is really standing with Putin. It helps Xi establish, again, his desire to dominate the norms, principles, activities of international politics, to set the future, if you will, of international politics. His vision for international politics is advanced as a result of this. Also, Frank, and very importantly, with this alliance, it's making aggression against Taiwan more likely, right? Another strategic indicator is that he's securing his northern flank. He has his western flank secure, but he hopes to rope in Russian military might, including its nuclear capability, which is prodigious, and a cause of great concern, of course, to the United States. So that if and when China attacks Taiwan, the United States will face a more complicated deterrence calculus. It not only has to worry about Chinese military might, which is formidable and has grown, but also that Russia is in a relationship, perhaps an extended deterrent relationship with China, in which case the U.S. calculus is greatly complicated. If the U.S. has to face Russia and China simultaneously.
To put those in layman terms, if we are in fact confronting not one, but two very powerful nuclear powers, our calculations about the adequacy of our deterrent and the way forward is going to be, as you say, complicated. Dr. Bradley Thayer is with us. We'll be right back on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Have you noticed the peculiar reporting about the mass murder at a Nashville elementary school yesterday? It's striking as much for what is not being said as what is. Consider, for example, how this shooting would have been covered if a practicing Christian had attacked a school or other venue populated by so-called transgender individuals instead of
the other way around. You can bet the narrative would have been all about the threat posed to a victimized community by militant Christianity, and the perpetrator's character and associates would have been exhaustively critiqued. In this case, we need to examine and determine if government officials' othering of Christians as potential domestic terrorists and violent extremists is contributing to increasing persecution of believers here. Moreover, whether such behavior was a decisive factor in this attack or not, it must be condemned and stopped now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome once again. We are continuing this really important conversation with one of our country's leading experts on the Chinese Communist Party. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is the co-author of a terrific new book entitled Understanding the China Threat. And we've been talking with him about the nature of that threat. It's animus that is being, it seems, encouraged at least in part by internal dynamics within China, as well as now a increasingly tightening relationship with Vladimir Putin. And Brad, we talked earlier about how after the No Limits partnership was unveiled, I think it was on the eve of the or at the very beginning of the Olympic Games, with the understanding, apparently, that nothing would happen in Ukraine until after they were over, which is pretty much what took place. But do you think that what is going on in Moscow now is setting the stage for the green lighting of Chinese aggression, presumably backed by the Russians, against our friends and allies, maybe even our own assets, personnel, and territory as well?
I think that's certainly the case, that all Putin has is essentially Xi Jinping. And Putin is responsible for getting himself in that situation. And we won't shed tears concerning that because he did it to himself and to the Russian people. And the Russian people are incurring the...
Let me ask you that, because Brad, as a serious student of these matters, I'd like to get your opinion on this. We are being told by a lot of people that we drove Putin into the Chinese arms, that it's our fault that he is now aligned with them as closely as he seems to be. Your thoughts?
Well, with respect to that, it's quite clear that the United States should have had a better relationship with Russia, recognizing that Russia would never be an ally of the United States, but it would have been to our tremendous benefit to use Russia and Russian military might in our competition with China. That's not to say that there would be an alliance relationship. That would never happen. Between Washington and NATO and Moscow. However, you might have gotten Russian neutrality. You might have gotten Russia taking a slice of the pie, if you will, and to stand with us against China, because, of course, China is a formidable threat to Russia as well. Now, what Putin decided to do was to bandwagon with China. And so he'll...
Just a point on this, because I know this caught your attention too, Brad. One of the tells about the abiding, at least potential for conflict between the Russians and the Chinese, is this revelation that recently, on the eve of the visit to Moscow, no less, by Xi Jinping, Chinese cartographers were publishing maps with 8 cities in eastern Russia given Chinese names, kind of a clue of perhaps their belief that they will be once again, as they say it, once again, Chinese. But Brad, to your point, are you saying that with Putin in charge in the Kremlin, there was actually a reasonable chance he would not prefer to be aligned with the Chinese against us rather than neutral, let alone perhaps aligned with us?
I think Putin's calculus was this, that his desire to achieve his objectives in Ukraine trumped, if you will, his better sense of Russia's long-term interests, which is to stay out of the shadow of China, to stay essentially not under the thumb, not under the domination of China. As a result of his actions, he's lost that. So he's now tied, if you will. They're prisoners on a chain gang, right? They're linked together, and Putin forged that fetter himself to Xi Jinping, who's definitely in the driver's seat and is going to be for some time. So Putin is along for the ride now, wherever Xi takes him and however Xi takes him. And if Putin doesn't serve Xi's interest, Xi will execute regime change against him, right? If Putin now tries to resist, Xi will work with essentially agents within Russia to eliminate him. So Putin did this himself. Anyway, so Xi, of course, and this all gets back to how he is setting the strategic foundation, right? We're getting, you know, what is a strategic indicator of an attack? Another one is changing an alliance behavior. And what have we seen? We have seen, of course, that China's relationship with Russia has greatly warmed from what it was. And the consequences of that are dire for all of U.S. interests in Europe, in Africa, South America, in South Asia, and East Asia, the Indo-Pacific. We have now the concern that we're facing this dual alliance between Moscow and Beijing. And yes, there are centrifugal tendencies within it, but for the time being, right, the centripetal tendency is going to be a greater one, and they're going to stay together.
They'll be hanging together, as they say.
Enormous risk for us on Taiwan, because this, again, secures his alliance relationship. It secures his northern flank, his western flank. It greatly complicates our calculus when we're thinking about deterring aggression against Taiwan, but also against other issues, other areas as well. Expertly, he's also trying to put a brake on India, because of Russia's ties to India and influence still that remains in New Delhi with Moscow. And so, of course, Xi is well aware of the hostility from India and using Russia as a cudgel or as an agent of influence to ensure that Modi does not intervene. Modi stays out of it when the war gets
in the Pacific.
Pacific, right? Yeah. And so it's the U.S., Japan, and Australia that would carry the burden largely with other actors.
Brad, we have to take another final short break. When we come back, I want to just stitch this together, because I think what you've portrayed is a very alarming picture of a coming new front in this war, maybe more than one, but truly a global conflagration seems now decidedly in prospect. We'll address that topic, among others, with Dr. Bradley Thayer, author, co-author of Understanding the China Threat, right after this. We're back for this final installment of a remarkably comprehensive assessment of where things stand with the Chinese Communist Party under its newly coronated, at least, emperor, Xi Jinping. And in particular, what the summit with Vladimir Putin now underway in Moscow is likely to portend. And Brad, I just wanted to comment on something that you said, because I think it's so important to really getting our heads around the kind of threat environment we find ourselves in now, vis-a-vis specifically China, but also China's allies or partners. You went through kind of a laundry list of places around the world, Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, the subcontinent of Asia, Asia proper, Europe even, where we are now seeing the fruits of a very concerted effort that Xi has called the Belt and Road Initiative, among other influence operations and efforts to romance leaders, nations, populations around the world. That has the prospect, as it entails the build out of a massive colonial infrastructure, notably of ports and airfields and rail networks and roadways and, you know, exploitation of strategic minerals and so much more, that those assets could, in the course of a future conflict, be weaponized against us by the Chinese Communist Party, giving rise to a global threat unlike anything we've ever faced, even two world wars, so-called heretofore. Am I missing something, or unfortunately, does that seem to be the case?
Well, that's a tremendous vulnerability, Frank, that again, we've introduced ourselves as a result of engagement with China and allowing that to occur. In World War II, we didn't allow the fascist Italians or the Nazis or the Japanese militarists to run our ports or to have any type of influence within our ports. Obviously, just the opposite. Americans ran American ports. Well, what are we seeing today? Chinese technology that could be manipulated through cyber means and other means in our electrical grid, of course, as so much great work has been done by the Center for Security Policy on securing the electrical grid, but our ports and vulnerabilities there. China has identified, of course, the choke points. And a choke point is always logistics. And if you control the ports, if you control vessels, for example, flagged obviously by China, but also other countries around the world, Malta, Panama, so many others that would be under Chinese influence, as well as the Panama Canal, as well as key European ports, key ports in Asia. What have they done? They've essentially dominated the straw, if you will, both ends of the straw through which everything has to pass logistically, either to come from the U.S., to project power in the Indo-Pacific, and then within the Indo-Pacific, the ports and the vessels that would move, do the heavy lifting, of course, which is so essential in any military operation. So while they're controlling...
Including literally the cranes that are in our ports used to move cargo and other items on and off ships. You know, Brad, I was struck, one of our colleagues, Joseph Heumeier of the Center for a Secure Free Society, calculates that there may be 40 different ports in Latin America alone that the Chinese Communist Party now either operates, as you say, or is literally building on both sides of the, you know, the continent. And it's just hard to overstate how dramatically this could affect, well, as you say, logistics, yes, but also the course of, you know, combat operations, if it should come to that. And I guess I just wanted to, you know, ask you to summarize in conclusion this remarkably comprehensive treatment of the challenge we're facing. Do you expect, coming out of this Moscow summit, Bradley Thayer, a now impending conflict, either in the Pacific, including places we call home, but also perhaps truly globally, with the support of the Russians to the extent that they can muster it, And that notwithstanding this long tradition of going back to, I guess, Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese strategist of, you know, centuries ago, millennia ago, that it's better to win without fighting, that the Chinese are now set on actually engaging in combat against us and others.
Well, Frank, in this regard, you have to think like a communist, not like a Chinese strategist. So communists are all about breaking things and forcing history, forcing events to occur through their own action. They're not passive, waiting for events to develop or a calculus or some future event that might occur. They're about grabbing history and forcing history to do what they want. So when we look at the Chinese Communist Party, we need to think like communists rather than as, if you will, the insights that come from Chinese civilization, Chinese traditional strategic thought. So,
let alone how we might perceive things or do things, right?
We don't think like that, right? We're far more passive, and we think that we have certainly a different emphasis and different calculus. Now,
we're a status quo power. Let's face it; we're not interested in changing everything around.
Indeed, and almost any change would be bad for us. It's going to be negative for the United States. So when we think about that, we can see that Minahan got a lot right, but things that Minahan might have missed in his excellent memo, essentially pulsing Air Mobility Command, and we would hope that other commanders have echoed what U.S. Air Force General Mike Minahan advanced, so that they pulse their own commands to get them ready. He missed the Russian alliance, certainly, and how that would affect. And then he also missed, I think, the recognition that these guys are communists. And yes, the Biden administration may be the best administration the Chinese Communist Party is ever going to get to act against Taiwan.
I think bar none, take it to the bank, folks. Brad Thayer, we are out of time. That hour has flown by, as it always does. We appreciate both your expertise and your time today. Come back to us, as I hope you will.
Thank you, Frank.
Updates very soon. God bless you in the meantime, and great job on understanding the China threat. Thanks to the rest of you for being with us. I hope you come back next time for more. Until then, go forth and multiply.